this happened about 45 minutes ago at the State Department.
Russia has jeopardized the United States security interest, and we can no longer be restricted by the treaty while Russia shamelessly violates it.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announcing that we are pulling out of a Cold War nuclear treaty with Russia. CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland joins us live now. This has to do with missiles in Europe. So what's at stake here, Jeff?
What's at stake here, Dave, is a landmark treaty that was signed in 1987 by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, which eliminated a whole class of land-based missiles with ranges between 500 and 5,000 kilometers. We have to keep in mind, this was signed during the height of the Cold War, a concern that the Russians, by having such missiles, could in fact threaten Europe, decouple Europe in many ways from the United States strategic deterrent, and therefore allow Russian or Soviet large-scale conventional forces to in fact have greater threat and provide greater influence on NATO policies. This treaty includes a very robust verification regime where American and Russian inspectors come into both countries to ensure we're in compliance. And we have charged the Russians since 2014 with violating the agreement by creating a new missile called the 9M729 cruise missile, which we say violates the treaty. There's been a back and forth on this since then. The Trump administration in October announced that they would pull out of the treaty if the Russians did not comply. Negotiations to accomplish that task have not come to fruition. And now the United States begins the formal six-month period of withdrawal from the agreement.
So this new Russian cruise missile, is it similar to our cruise missiles?
It's similar to our cruise missiles, but within that particular range, whereas our cruise missiles, one could argue, exceed those particular ranges. Or in our case, most of our cruise missiles, all of our cruise missiles, I should say, are sea-based or in some cases air-based systems, dropped from airplanes, launched from ships. Mm-hmm. No restrictions on missiles. This is only land-based systems.
Okay, so the verification system that goes along with this treaty, if we drop out, would that verification system end as well?
Absolutely. There would be no verification.
Well, then they get away with anything then.
They can do whatever they like. And that's one of the arguments that those who have said, even though we believe and have believed very, very firmly that the Russians are in violation for the last 5 years or more that we should keep the treaty, is for that verification regime. And to some degree, it restricts the Soviets, the Russians, I should say, from really a breakout and a dramatic increase in the number of these systems. That being said, based on the state of the Russian economy, I would be very surprised that we would see the Russians create a dramatic increase in the number of these systems, though this probably will increase them somewhat. And there is a report today that they may have already at least four battalions of these particular missiles.
Okay, so the real point of dropping out then would be for us to be able to ratchet up our missile system. Is that correct?
That, plus, of course, the basic idea of holding people accountable to agreements they make, which makes part of the international system. And part and parcel of this particular discussion, and you're quite right, Dave, has been the administration concerned that China, not restricted by this treaty at all, has been able to create its own stockpile of weapons within these particular range, and now the United States needs to think about, do we need to counter that?
Are these nuclear weapons?
These can be either conventional or nuclear systems. It is really a restriction on the missile and the launcher system that goes with that particular missile. And of course, most of them were designed to have a nuclear warhead.
So, but these are strategic. No, we're back to the years when we were threatening to blow up each other's cities?
Exactly. I mean, what this really is part and parcel of, again, the Soviets' ability, now Russians' ability, to threaten the Europeans. Missiles of these range from Russia do not threaten the U.S. homeland range isn't great enough, but they do potentially have an impact on our European allies. European allies were somewhat surprised when, back in October, the Trump administration suddenly announced that we were going to withdraw. Subsequently, NATO collectively has called on Moscow to come back into compliance, but so far at least, our NATO partners have stopped short from outright endorsing the United States' withdrawal from the INF Treaty. And, of course, they're not signatories. It's simply a signatory agreement between us and the Russians.
Okay, but if the Russians, you say it's confined to Europe, but if the Russians blow up Frankfurt, then we're morally obligated to blow up Moscow, aren't we?
That's exactly right. And that's where the treaty came from, because of the concern that with these shorter-range systems and longer-range systems that might deter the United States, that this gave them some advantage back during the Cold War. But that was back in the days of a much different strategic strategic environment, a bipolar system, huge Soviet conventional military forces that under that umbrella of deterrence might be able to threaten Europe. Obviously, that's all gone. I've met frequently in negotiations with the Russians about this treaty, and they've told me from their standpoint, now in a different world, a multipolar world, a world in which they feel conventionally inferior to NATO, they need such weapons as a deterrent against threats to them. We've actually sort of taken the whole problem and stood it on its head.
Is this about men swinging their testosterone around? What sane person, whether Russian, American, or Chinese, really thinks you accomplish anything by blowing up a city and then getting yourself blown up in return? I just don't get it.
Well, it's not really blowing up the city. The argument, of course, is that by threatening to do that, you will deter your opponent from taking some action. It's this almost religious belief that people follow who subscribe to analysis of deterrence theory. And quite frankly, John Bolton, I think that his hands are all over this as the national security advisor to President Trump, who's been a very, very outspoken critic of this treaty for many, many years.
Right. Well, it's all very, the mutual assured destruction works until the day somebody decides, yeah, I'm actually going to press the button, and then it sounds like a bad idea to me. So tell me, do they move the hands of the clock closer to midnight now, or is this really just a lot of posturing?
Well, it's funny you should say that, Dave, because the Bolton, the atomic scientist, which annually makes that particular determination, just made their announcement a few days ago, and they left the clock at 2 minutes to midnight. But they were very careful to point out that that they hadn't moved it forward should not cause one, to relax, because there is a very, very complex now new international security system that is emerging with all kinds of new threats from multipolar places, number one, from domains traditional like nuclear weapons, one could say, from terrorists, from cyber, etc. In many ways, you might say the Cold War was a lot less complicated.
Wow. CBS military analyst, retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Thank you for making our morning, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave.
All right. Hannah Scott, who was at the Howard Schultz event last night in downtown Seattle. So how'd it go?
Well, it started out like this.
Pick a party! Pick a party!
This was outside of the Moore Theater. There were about 50 or so protesters who came out to speak out against him, including State Democratic Party Chair Tina Podlodowski.
I don't trust you to make sure that everyone else gets the same opportunity to get to the ballot box. So, Howard, I got two words for you. Just don't!
Now, some of those people didn't want him to run at all. Others just wanted him not to run as an independent. Inside, it was a more welcoming crowd, though largely made up of current and former Starbucks workers and store operators.
I personally think he would be great, but I think there's a lot of backlash just because people don't know him like we do at Starbucks. I think that's the hard part, is how are we going to show everyone how wonderful he is? He just wants to be the good guy. You know, he wants to do better.
For the country, I think he would be a tremendous leader, probably better than any leader we've seen in a long, long time.
Now, some of his supporters agreed it was time to get the country away from the two-party system and liked the idea of an independent candidate. And while admitting it was an uphill battle, felt that if anybody could do it, it was Schultz. From the stage, Schultz also admitted it was an uphill battle, but he said he felt that there was an appetite.
I think there are millions of Americans who believe, as I do, that the system is broken, the system is rigged, and there is a better opportunity. And can you imagine, just imagine, for the first time in history since George Washington, that an independent person could actually win? And what that would mean, the message we would send to Congress, to elected officials who are interested in their own ideology, their own self-interest, their own self-preservation, to finally say the people have spoken and we want disruptive change in our system.
Now, as for being criticized by Democrats and others for potentially splitting the vote and giving the President Trump a second term.
There has been a rush to judgment that if, in fact, I were to proceed, that automatically that would reelect Donald Trump. I will do nothing on any level to proceed if I thought that in proceeding that I would in any way persuade Americans to vote and reelect Donald Trump. That is not going to happen. So
that sounds like a pretty good fail-safe plan. So I assume what he's thinking of doing then, he's rolled himself out, he's going to give interviews, he's going to go around the country, then at some point he conducts a poll. And if there's no chance of him winning, he drops out like in the beginning of 2020.
Yeah, absolutely. He said he was going to, you know, basically test the waters. I think he's got six more appearances across the country in the next coming weeks. He's going to test the waters, see what happens. And if it looks like he's doing anything in any way to catapult President Trump somehow, then he's definitely out. And if he is splitting the vote, anything like that, he would back away. So that, and he reiterated that several times last night, saying he would not be a spoiler.
Yeah. That's got to be encouraging for him, though, to have so much support from former employees. You don't often see that, it seems to me.
They, the ones I talked to in the crowd, I didn't talk to everyone, but I mean, they adore this guy. They say he's, you know, he's very humble. He doesn't brag about the things that he's done for these people. Yeah. One woman said she got all free college because of him, and you know how much better her life is because of that. They really adore him. They like his ideas.
Yeah. Okay. The Sonics come up in the event last night.
They did. They did. He gave a long description about why they were sold, and basically he said, you know, we were losing money. We went to the city. Their lease was bad. The city wasn't going to help. But in the end, he says, the buck stops with him.
But I'm responsible for what took place. And I think the lesson is when you have power and responsibility, like I did with the Sonics, you must demonstrate restraint. And it's a very hard lesson. I have to live with that lesson. And it's a mistake that I made. And I apologize.
And that was met with cheers, by the way.
Yeah. So he's going to try and turn that negative into a positive. As somebody who has a little more humility than the current occupant of the Oval Office, maybe. Now, there was a promise. And apparently, he got off on the wrong foot with the press last night. Tell me about that.
So, absolutely. I think he lost the hometown press crowd if he had it to begin with. His staff people sent to all of the media who were there, and I know in my case I got two, and they were unsolicited. I didn't ask for Q&A with him afterwards. It was offered to me twice, and it was offered to all the other media there. We all gathered as the regular crowd left, and we were waiting to get his contact person, find out where this press gaggle we were promised was going to be. Out of nowhere, it wasn't going to happen. The woman telling me that was the same woman who had said it was going to happen in the first place. We all asked why. She said logistics. We said, what logistics? He's right there at the front of the stage signing books with people.
Yeah.
And so we, as a group of reporters, went down to the stage and decided we're all just going to ask. We were promised a press gaggle. It, you know, and the reason this is important is because it's one moderator on the stage is pre-rehearsed.
Right.
You get a chance to ask questions and get some ideas on his policies and get some better answers from him. He ignored us, all of us. We were right there, and we said, Mr. Schultz, we were asking you for, we were promised a press gaggle. Why aren't we getting it? He had security escort him out and essentially fled the theater.
Hmm. Well, I would say that was a mistake.
I do. Yeah. I would agree.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
To Margaret Brennan. She has a pretty busy Sunday, not just as host of Face the Nation, but host of a pregame interview with President Donald Trump.
We have a long list of questions to ask President Trump, not just about his thoughts on who's going to win the game, but his thoughts on whether we're going to face another government shutdown in a few weeks, how he intends to get the money for his border wall, and exactly what his plans are for U.S. troops, because he's threatening or saying he's got a military option on the table for Venezuela. Why do that when you're bringing troops home from Syria and Afghanistan?
Yeah, well, maybe that's going to be their next assignment. Who knows? But can you get it? Can you pin him down on exactly how he defines a wall? Because apparently that's been evolving.
Right. It's been evolving. That is one of the big debates on Capitol Hill, because the president has also, as you say, evolved. He's changed what he's asked for from the campaign when he talked about concrete sea, true shining sea. Now he's talking about just steel slats and 200 miles. But what you have heard from Democrats and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is that there will be no money for a wall, some kind of fencing perhaps, but not what the president has described.
Well, she said in her news conference yesterday, no concrete wall and no slats either, but Normandy fencing would be okay. And that's sort of a low barrier that's designed to stop vehicles, but which anybody could climb over. So let me ask you this. Based on the stand that she has taken, no slats, no concrete wall, mm-hmm. would she be in favor of removing the parts of the fence that, you know, cannot be climbed over at the moment? I mean, I'm not sure where the Democrats stand here on barriers.
Right. And this is one of the things that's being debated, because it seems to be an opposition in principle rather than in practical detail in many ways. Because when you talk to Democrats who have voted in the past for legislation that provided fencing, like in 2006 with the Secure Fencing Act. There's the idea that perhaps that's an opening. You could mimic that same language and get everyone to agree that it's a good idea since they agreed to it in the past. But because this has been made, as the speaker says, a moral issue, right? Referring to the wall as immoral, as it's symbolic of something different than just border security strategy, but perhaps code for what she has accused the president of doing in terms of making racially inflammatory statements, et cetera. They're both still in their corners on this. But what we do know is that President Trump has said he's going to try to bypass Congress, whether it's through national emergency or finding funding elsewhere to build this wall. But there is a debate, and this is what we should be talking about, which is what is the best way to secure the border. And certainly there's a strong argument to be made that it's not the most practical or efficient way to protect it. But instead, we're talking about, you know, whether it is symbolic.
Yeah. Well, the president certainly has been harping on this idea of national security being dependent on a good, sturdy, solid wall because of the danger of terrorism and the criminals who are crossing. I'm sure that's going to come up at the State of the Union. And it sounds to me like he's laying down the basis for a national security argument to declare a national emergency. What's your sense of that?
Yes, I think you're right. I think this is something, though, that, as we've said before, kind of opens the door to dangerous precedent being set. If it's an emergency, then how can you wait another 3 weeks if it's truly an emergency? And is this just simply a way to bypass Congress in a way that another president in the future could replicate and continue to, you know, sort of bend the rules, right? The reason that Congress was put there for an advising consent role is so that we have the most prudent decisions being made, not just the will of the executive.
Margaret Brennan, host of Face the Nation. Her guest this Sunday, the President of the United States. And now, packing up his troubles in his old kit bag. Here's Tom Tagney for the Friday Film Review. If you're not watching on the webcam, you can't tell that Tom is in full color this morning. His hues are very vibrant.
That's right.
He is three-dimensional, and that sounds a lot like this movie. I've seen some of the previews for They Shall Not Grow Old.
Yes.
And I said, they must have done this in a studio.
Yes.
Or in a soundstage, because the quality is so good, and you don't see that with World War I movies.
This is really amazing. You know, Peter Jackson is the guy behind this film, and he's a master showman. The guy who turned Tolkien into a multi-billion-dollar cinematic phenomenon with his Lord of the Rings and Hobbit films now turns his expertise to grainy old World War I footage, and in a lot of ways the results are even more fantastic. They Shall Not Grow Old is a documentary made up entirely of 100-year-old Imperial War Museum footage, much of which we may have already seen in scores of World War I documentaries over the years. But oh, what a difference. And that difference is put on full display with one artistic masterstroke. The first 10 minutes consist of a silent black-and-white footage projected onto a square, smallish screen in the middle of your standard movie screen. It shows streams of British men, young and old, but mostly young, enlisting, then learning how to be soldiers in boot camp, and finally being shipped off to France. The moment they set foot in France, however, is when the magic happens. The screen image suddenly expands to full length. The black and white gives way to color, and the soldiers appear in 3D amidst a naturalistic soundtrack. The effect is powerful, making me feel like I had just time traveled 100 years in a split second. Those ghostly people who I had been dutifully watching on the screen suddenly became living, breathing human beings, as relatable as soldiers in 2019. Occasionally, a soldier will even look straight at the camera and say something to us. It's startling. The emotional impact of this transformation does wear off a bit throughout the course of the 99-minute movie, but not a lot. And there are some moments that are so graphic, you're apt to forget them anytime soon. Countless shots of bloodied young men, some of them walking wounded, others mere crumpled corpses on the battlefields or in the trenches. Scenes of dead and dying horses, hastily dug pits where human bodies are piled up willy-nilly, and hundreds of rats scurrying everywhere. For a little levity, the film also offers up images of makeshift latrines, where a half dozen men are seated on a log over another pit with their backsides all on display. Now, Jackson enhances this immersive approach by excluding all historical dates and geographical markers. There's no voiceover narration explaining military strategy. This is exclusively a grunt's eye view of World War I. It's the frontline experience of trench warfare. The only context we get is reminiscences of survivors who recorded their memories 40 years later in the 1960s.
He got so degenerate, so isolated, living in this mud.
And you could sympathize with how a rabbit must feel, because we were hunted by mankind just the same as a rabbit. You lived like tramps. You didn't polish any buttons. You wore any uniform bits that you liked, and nobody worried. All they were concerned with was that you were fit to fight.
When the war was not very active, it was really rather fun to be in the front line. It was not very dangerous, a sort of out-of-door camping colony with the boys, with a slight spice of danger to make it interesting.
Now, as amazing...
Did he just say it was kind of fun to be on the front lines?
Yeah, when you weren't engaged in battle, there's a lot of scenes of camaraderie among these guys, and they're making jokes and they're crying. Yeah. It's just like, you know, a bunch of guys hanging out like in a locker room or something. And he says, so when you literally weren't facing, you know, life and death experiences, there was a lot of kind of fun. And so if you survived, remember, the only people we're hearing from are the people that did survive. Right. There was an element of camaraderie. But as amazing, Dave, as Jackson's accomplishment is, the story of how he pulled it off deserves equal attention. Jackson and his team looked at over 100 hours of original war footage. It was dirty, scratched, and torn, and Jackson spent much of the last 5 years simply restoring the frames to their original pristine black and white. Contributing to the difficulty was that the film had been shot on hand-crank cameras at various speeds, mostly only half as fast as movie exhibition standards. That required his team to use all their computer know-how to adjust the film speeds to modern standards. As a result, all those herky-jerky movements we're used to seeing are gone, and in their places are naturalized and instantly recognizable body movements. And perhaps most effectively at all, Jackson hired forensic lip readers to figure out what was being said on camera. Remember, it was filmed silently. Wow. Then hired regional actors to say their lines with proper accents. It's flat out eerie.
Well, boys, here he comes. We're in the pictures.
We're in the pictures 100 years ago. That
so that's what they did. I was trying to figure out how they get
yes.
the soundtrack.
Yeah, it's incredible. The film's title comes from a remembrance poem about all the men who died in war, but it gains new meaning thanks to Jackson's efforts. They shall never grow old because they've been forever captured and preserved in film in all their glorious youth.
Wow. It sounds spectacular, yeah. Like I say. And strategy of starting with the black and white and going to color. That's the Wizard of Oz.
That's the Wizard of Oz. It also, you know, it sort of reminds me, remember the great scene in 2001 where you have the ape man hitting the bone suddenly turns into a spaceship. It has that kind of whoosh through the ages. It's very effective.
Remarkable. Thank you, Tom. And how many tangs?
3.5 tangs
four
out of four.
3.5 tangs out of four. Okay, pretty good. There they are. A little late. Okay.
And now for your daily dose of kindness. Most people love a good cup of joe, but for one coffee shop owner, serving up the daily dose isn't complete without a side of kindness. CBS's Meg Oliver has more.
Every day at Cafe Fresco, a small staff bustles behind the counter, brewing coffee and inspiration with handwritten encouragement on its cup sleeves.
Yes. Do you have a favorite?
I think this one, the... Believe there is good in the world. Be the good.
Some might say 31-year-old Brianne Zolfo is better than good. The former nanny opened this coffee house 6 years ago and on a whim started writing the uplifting messages for customers.
Well, I just hope that it would add some positive light to their day.
Customer reaction was overwhelming, so much that she took it further.
Just have to go drop change in a Salvation Army jar and film it.
Challenging them to perform good deeds for a free cup of joe.
Pay for someone's coffee, donate clothes to a homeless shelter.
So how many free cups of coffee have you given out?
Oh, thousands and thousands.
Is that such a good business plan?
I mean, I feel like if you're spreading positivity, people want to be a part of positivity, good people helping good people.
The fabric of Crown Point is tightly knit, and for Zolfo, serving that community goes well beyond the walls of her cafe. Instead of pocketing the cash from the store's tip jar, she pays it forward every month.
Hello, how are you?
On this day, she uses the money to surprise shoppers at a nearby supermarket.
Have a good day.
What just happened?
We spent on your groceries.
What you do that for?
You guys spread positivity.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Give me a hug.
Oh,
yes.
Of course.
Thank you.
Have people come to thank you?
Yeah.
What's that like?
We had this one person that he was homeless, and we had bought a bike for him. And he came back 2 years later after we had purchased the bike for him, and he said, "You don't know how much you've changed my life. Like, because you bought me a bike, I got a job, and I got an apartment." And so even talking about it makes me cry.
And how has this changed the community?
I hope that it spread positivity throughout, like, not just this community, but other communities that are around us. For us to play a small part in a lot of people's lives is the most amazing feeling.
Thank you, Carolyn. That's time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. Now here he is from the 710 ESPN bullpen, where everyone knows which two teams are in the Super Bowl, Danny O'Neill. Sean McVay is the young and clever coach.
Oh, you can say youngest. Youngest coach ever to coach in a Super Bowl.
So youngest coach, yeah. How old is he?
He's 33, just turned 33.
It's crazy.
Happy birthday to him.
And he's considered very innovative.
That's correct.
So
cutting edge.
So explain what is cutting edge about the way he coaches.
Well, he's gotten a high-powered offense, a team that was ranged from outright awful to decidedly mediocre for the 10 years before he arrived. And he got there and he pushed them over the top. And in his two seasons, I believe his record is 24-8 in the regular season. He's now 2-1 in the postseason.
But how'd he do it? Just by yelling at him or what?
No, he got it by them playing an up-tempo, aggressive offense, a lot of throws to the running back out of the backfield, motion on pretty much every play, what's called the fly sweep, where the wide receiver comes in motion.
Oh, I think I saw that.
And you can't tell whether or not they might hand it to the wide receiver who's running laterally and essentially gets a running start to the edge. They might hand it to the running back who's coming out of the back, or the quarterback might choose to keep it and throw the ball down the field.
So deceit, trickery.
A little bit, forcing defenses to account for something that they've not traditionally had to account for in the NFL, which is that wide receiver being in motion, potentially being a runner.
But then he's up against Bill Belichick, who's the cagey old man. He's like the 80-year-old squash player who can beat you by standing still on the court.
That's one way to look at it. I call him the constipated genius.
The constipated genius.
Because if you look at him, he does not look like he's had a healthy bowel movement in months.
Well, but that helps make him more ruthless.
I don't know.
It?
I would think it makes him uncomfortable, right. And that might explain the fact that if the man ever smiles, it appears that his face is in grave danger of cracking and falling off.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, he is. Now, his team is playing in the Super Bowl for the ninth time in 18 seasons.
Right.
He's been there for 20 years, and it is one of the all-time runs. I guess this is his 19th season. It is one of the all-time runs for a coach in the NFL. It's unbelievable what he's been able to do.
Right, and he's done that because of his experience, because of his constipation. What is the secret?
We don't think his constipation has much to do with it. He has created and engendered a culture of uncertainty and fear.
Uh-huh.
He motivates by certainly an old school, you lose your job, and man, we will get rid of you the moment we think it's advantageous for this team.
Uh-huh.
He's also, if you listen to some people, they've been caught cheating twice.
Well,
at least
that's
what the NFL says.
So a little skullduggery.
Right. So there's some people that think he's the best cheater that's been out there.
So really, this is a symbolic matchup of two contrasting governing styles.
Yes. This is old school versus new school. And Bill Belichick is the defensive-minded coach. He came up under Bill Parcells, and that is his baby. He's got a great quarterback, and he's got his defense. And that's going to match up against Sean McVay, who has his offense. So it is offense versus defense, old versus new, constipation versus free-flowing, plant-based. I don't know if Sean McVay is really
Trump
plant-based.
Trump versus Kamala, it's everything.
Yeah. We don't need to get political, Dave.
No, we don't.
It's very sensitive, that topic in the NFL. Although, if we're going to go that way, Bill Belichick did write a letter to Trump, either after his nomination or after his election, which got a lot of people bent out of shape.
Right. You're right. Let's not get into politics. I spend too much time on that anyway. Here's the big question I've got for you. This is on the prop bets. One of the prop bets, well, actually several of the prop bets concern what Maroon 5 will do during the halftime show.
Yeah.
Like one of them is what will be the first song they play? Is it going to be Moves Like Jagger, Girls Like You, One More Night, Payphone, Sunday Morning? I don't recognize a single one of these
songs.
I'm
so proud that I have no idea and I wouldn't know how to adjudicate
that. But here's
my
question.
No clue.
Here's my question. When you have prop bets that are based on things that are a matter of a human choice, why couldn't Adam Levine just put scads of money on one of these propositions and make scads of money?
It's a very good question, Dave. I always wondered the same thing because there are people that take bets on pro wrestling.
Yeah.
They know the outcome of those.
So would it, now my next question is, of course it's morally wrong, but...
Well, is it? I think it might be morally wrong to let a sucker keep his money.
I think it's morally wrong. I realize that you're
what are you saying?
Your whole brand is to say the opposite of what I do. But that's okay. I want to know if it could actually get you in criminal trouble.
No way.
So
why?
So in other words, you can just do this
and
rip off these gullible people.
Wait, you're asking if there's... Hold on. Let me drill down on this.
Consequences.
You're asking if there's legal consequences.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Or if there's a legal protection for someone who is accepting an illegal bet, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Because unless you're in Las Vegas, accepting these prop bets is entirely illegal.
Oh, I see. So, but you could go to Vegas.
Yes.
So, and if you had a connection to Adam Levine, there, you could just make your fortune like right there.
The casino's entitled to not accept your bet. So if you came in and bet $2 million on something, they would probably say the risk of this actually being someone that knows something.
I wouldn't bet $2 million all at once.
No. I'd space it out.
Yeah, just a bunch of $100,000 bets.
Oh, what about your moral high ground now? Oh, my brand is I do everything opposite.
I just want to follow.
Dave, it seems like you've got the convoluted plan to
I just
trick
want to follow the law.
Okay. Yes, you could do that. Yes, okay. Conceivably that is true. And no, there would be no legal repercussions.
Okay, then I'm going
to
show.
If you're dumb enough to take a bet on information that can be known in advance, you deserve to get fleeced, to tipped over, or whatever.
Okay. So now I'm going to prove to you how virtuous I am. Even though I know I couldn't get in trouble for arranging such a thing, I'm not going to do it.
Why not?
Dave, I'll toss you and Danny one. The over-under that I'm going to watch that ridiculous halftime show. It's zero.
You don't want to watch Maroon 5?
I never want. No. I have zero interest in
that. Did you miss Janet Jackson then if you were so adamant about not watching it?
No, well, I only watch bands that are remotely entertaining or play decent music. So, yeah, that counts
there's
out.
Nothing. Maroon 5 is a totally studio-created, designed to be non-controversial, ear candy.
I've never even heard one of their songs, and I don't care to. No, that's Michael Jackson.
No, he's got a little bit of that.
Yeah.
Adam Levine does. He's got a little bit of that.
Yeah. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Last year, a group of citizens tried to get universal health care on the ballot, but they came up short on signatures, and now a state senator is putting a proposal up in the legislature, and Chi Radio's Hannah Scott is here with that story.
Democratic Senator Bob Hasegawa has introduced the universal health care bill, which will create something called the Whole Washington Health Trust. The goal?
Tries to make sure that everyone gets coverage, which is not happening right now. And there are people that are being not just uninsured, but even with insurance coverage, people are being forced into crippling debt. So this is just an attempt to try and stabilize the healthcare system and make sure that everybody is covered and can do it affordably.
The trust would be run by a 9-member board of trustees that is appointed by the governor, and then they would be responsible for setting all of this up.
It requires a trust's essential health benefits package to constitute minimum essential coverage under the Affordable Care Act. And it sets, probably most importantly, the income levels and cost thresholds. So residents with incomes below 200% of the federal poverty level are not subject to any premiums, and then premiums themselves may not exceed $200 a month.
And he says, so this is not meant to compete with the governor's new health care proposal.
So is this the same as Obamacare?
No. He's talking about the affordable, Obamacare requires a certain amount of benefits, right?
Right.
So it's that standard of benefits is what would have to be provided under this. It doesn't work funding-wise or everything as the same as Obamacare. And he says this is different than the governor's health care proposal. It goes a bit further.
You have to have a vision that you're trying to achieve out there. If you just see these incremental steps without seeing what the final vision is, then you wonder, what are we doing? Are we making progress or not? Well, yeah, we're making maybe incremental progress, but to what end? Is life going to be better after all is said and done? So So if you can see where you're trying to get to out there, and that's what the main purpose of this bill is, to show that this is what we really want, something along this line where everybody is covered.
So who is this aimed at?
This is aimed at everyone who doesn't have coverage would get coverage, and you would the employees would have to pay into it. There was a ballot initiative that didn't make the ballot in November, I-1600. This is essentially that same thing. So it looks to get everyone covered if you're too
Well, I have no idea what that one said. That didn't get a lot of coverage. So is there a new tax involved in raising the money for this?
There's a lot of funding that goes into this. One, it would be you would have money taken out from your employers, right? There's also a capital gains tax involved in this funding, 8.5%. I believe that would have to start being set up next year.
That's going to be a heavy lift.
Yeah, employer payroll tax.
So suppose you already had insurance then through your employer.
Right. There's nothing that says so basically what he said there is if your employer doesn't have to transfer, it doesn't sound like. So if you could keep what you already had with your employer if it was as good or better, I think kind of like our paid leave.
Yeah.
Also, if you already had better insurance, private insurance on your own, this would be a secondary that you could use. You wouldn't have to give that other one up.
But when they say it's universal, is it something that then automatically goes to everyone and you just choose whether to use it or not?
Yes.
Sort of like public education. Everybody gets public education, but you could go to private school if you wanted to, as long as you keep paying for the public education.
Yes.
So the tax would be on everybody.
Yes.
But the benefits would only be for the people who actually needed it.
Who actually needed it. And it would qualify for every Washington State resident and college students who are non-residents.
Okay, very good.